All right, welcome to Guerrilla Radio Show, episode 94. I'm your host, Austin, and as always, I am joined by Chandran and Greg.
Hello, I'm Chandran. As always, you can find our links at guerrillaradio.show. You can get all of our information there.
So you may have already noticed that we have a guest this week, and we're very grateful. Tonight we're joined by Dr. Skiba of the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative. So welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. All right. So I guess to start out, I'll ask the first question. Can you tell us a little bit about your responsibilities at the Ape Initiative? And I guess just like what your overview of what the Ape Initiative is. I imagine we've talked about it on the show before, but, you know, just for posterity's sake.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ape Initiative, for anyone that doesn't know, is what is considered the only bonobo research center in the world, which might bring you to maybe ask, what is a bonobo? So bonobos are great apes, and along with chimpanzees, are the closest living relatives to humans. And the work that we do at Ape Initiative, which is a nonprofit organization, is we help understand bonobo behavior and then connect people to that species, which happens to be endangered in the wild. And so we'll probably get into some of the threats here in just a moment, but some of the things that threaten bonobo population in the wild, not surprisingly, are human activities, a lot of deforestation and habitat fragmentation, and then also the illegal bush meat and pet trades, which lead to population decline of these species. And so what Ape Initiative does is we work with researchers from across the globe to collect data with the bonobos, all behavioral and cognitive data, to help better understand their minds and how they think and how they act and why they act the way that they do. And for some of those researchers, in many ways, to better understand how we as humans got to be the way that we are. And so through that research, we also connect people to this species and help educate them about bonobos and their status in the wild to help try and mitigate some of those negative impacts that we're seeing in their home range, the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great overview, I think. So there's a lot to talk about with bonobos and conservation and all that, but one thing that did recently catch our eye, which was part of the reason I sent a follow-up email, was we recently watched the movie Primate. It's a horror movie, for those of you who don't know, released last month. I think I don't really know much about it other than it's put out by Paramount. Mm-hmm. And the director is Johannes Roberts. I guess he made some other Animal Attack movies. But as far as, you know, January movies go, not a great movie in our opinion. We do a little every once in a while when a movie about monkeys comes out, or we'll go back and watch them. We'll do a little bonus episode about it where we call it Monkey Movie Night. But essentially, we watch this movie, and within the first, 2 minutes, maybe even the first minute, it shows like a panning shot of an ape enclosure and
a chimp
very
enclosure, to be specific.
A chimp enclosure, and there's this lexigram, and I couldn't really tell if it was the exact kanzi, and well, not just kanzi uses it, but if it was the exact lexigram you guys use and kanzi has used, but it did seem to be at least evocative of it, if not exactly like an image of that lexigram. Do you know if it is the lexigram or not?
Yeah, that's a great question. So to start, Ape Initiative did not provide a lexigram keyboard to anyone affiliated with the movie. So if it looks to viewers a lot like the lexigram keyboard that the bonobos at Ape Initiative use, it was not done so by Ape Initiative providing that keyboard. And so the bonobos at Ape Initiative are the only living apes that still use a lexigram keyboard. So the keyboard was originally developed by Dr. Dwayne Rumbaugh, and work with Dr. Sue Savage Rumbaugh was done to teach the bonobos the lexigram keyboard. But this was done at Georgia State Language Research Center, actually in Atlanta. And all of the chimpanzees that were a part of those early studies have sadly since passed. And so the bonobos are the only living apes, non-human apes, that are still using the Lexigram keyboard. And so I do know that Ken Schweller, who has been affiliated with Ape Initiative for a very long time, had developed an app at one point to make the Lexigram keyboard accessible to actually Tico, one of the bonobos, on an iPad. And so I do know that there is something out there where you can get kind of a different looking or kind of slider version of the keyboard through the app. I also know that that app wasn't a part of anything provided by Ape Initiative to the movie. And so I think it's interesting to hear that there's a Lexigram keyboard in the film, and something I was quite surprised to see when I saw early advertisements of the movie start coming out.
Mm-hmm. So was the Lexigram in the advertisements? Because I didn't really see very many trailers. I just sort of knew about it because monkey things tend to float to me online.
So I did receive a few messages, and not just a few, actually several, from you know, individuals like yourself who had kind of followed around Kanzi's story or Ape Initiative's story, asking like, hey, I saw this trailer for this film coming out and that looks an awful lot like the keyboard, you know, is this something Ape Initiative's a part of? And so I do think in the trailer, there's a scene, I don't know exactly, I haven't seen the film itself, but in the trailer that I've seen, the main character, the chimpanzee, is using a like touch enabled device to tap on a Lexigram looking keyboard.
Yeah. So for the record, you probably don't need to see the movie. It's
it's very absolutely not.
If you've seen Jaws, you've seen this movie.
it's not good. It's not a good film. But the Lexigram features prominently at like, I would say, key moments of tension for the film.
Yeah,
three big moments.
It's, and they
it's
use
like
it very much as a plot device. So it's very, very prominently featured. Were you, Austin, do you remember if look, I know you have the Lexigram tattoo on your arm. Was that one on there? Like, did it match to what the board looks like?
I'm not sure. Because, again, it's... See, we went and saw it on a big screen, you know.
In theaters,
I'm a big theater guy.
We were three of maybe 10 people in the whole thing. So.
Yeah, I will say, like, and we'll get into this more. I was a bit worried about any kind of negative, like, cultural connotations this could have. Like, especially with what happened after Jaws, after that came out. Like, the huge resurgence, I guess, or just, like, maybe it wasn't
fomenting of like
a fomenting of fear of sharks that really kind of hindered shark conservation for a while. And there's a lot of discussion to be had about that, especially with regards to apes. But specifically, in the theater, I couldn't really tell. And that's part of why I reached out to ask.
It does have the classic like bright blue background, like that's on the web, that's like that's published. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what makes the Lexigrams so unique is they were really developed to not be symbolic. So when the research was originally being done to teach the apes these symbols, you know, a lot of the criticisms in the field or general kind of sentiments in the field were that, you know, symbolic representation was something that was very unique to humans, and that language is arbitrary in many ways, and that other species just can't possibly learn an arbitrary language. And so you'll notice in the symbols, they're purposely designed not to look like the items that they're describing. So the Lexigram for lemon is just like a squiggly set of, you know, the word lemon. The bonobos can't read words, so they obviously weren't reading the words of them, but the original designs were all geometric shapes that were actually, in some ways, I think, meant to mimic phonemes. And so like each by themselves meant nothing, but together in combination, they meant different words. I think as they developed more and more symbols, maybe the strictness of sticking to that design type kind of started to change as the research evolved. But they're very unique by design, and they're very much non-representational by design. And so if the animal in this film, this chimpanzee is using symbols that, you know, say the word banana, but the symbol looks nothing like banana. That's much more a lexigram thing than that is an augmented communication device thing that we see in humans. The work that's now being done in humans, there's not that barrier to us thinking, you know, we're better than another species. So actually the human device research has been focused on things that are representational by design, to make it easier for individuals who don't have language to communicate. And so if these symbols, like it, they're described and what I've seen in the trailer, sound much more lexigram-like than they sound traditional symbol-like.
Yeah, I feel like, thinking back on it now, I think it was, like, I recognized one of the symbols, maybe, and that's why I was like, was this, like, allowed? But yeah, Greg did actually set me up for a little brief segue thing here. Regarding the symbol I recognize, I think it might have been the one that I got tattooed, which around the time that Kanzi sadly passed away, I was thinking about tattoos to get, and because we were, like, looking back into Kanzi stuff, we were looking at the keyboard, and I noticed the symbol next to Kanzi was for Austin, and I was like, wait a minute, that's my name. And so I picked up this book from the library talking about, like, the initial experiments involving Austin the chimpanzee. I thought it was really cool and neat, so I got my name tattooed in lexigram, so I thought that was
fun.
Oh,
that's amazing. How cool.
But yeah, yeah, I don't know, the movie specifically is, this is probably a good point to start talking about it. Do you think that this will have more of a negative impact than it will, like, positive? Like, I don't see how it could be positive, other than maybe scaring people out of getting a pet, but I don't think that's necessarily what's going to happen.
No, I think you bring up a good point, Austin, and it's this kind of multifaceted or multi-layered issue, right? Like, I think that there is this idea of a pet chimpanzee in general that is the wrong image to be putting out. And so just like bonobos are endangered, chimpanzees are also endangered in the wild. And one of the larger threats is the pet trade. And so apologies to the viewers, but it'll get a little graphic here, or just like kind of sensitive warning to anyone here. But bonobo moms and adults are killed, and then the infants are taken off of their dead bodies and sold as pets in this illegal trade. The adults are smoked and eaten as meat, and the infants become trafficked across country lines and become in very, very poor welfare situations. Animals like chimpanzees and bonobos are extremely intelligent and social. They need their species-specific mom to raise them in order to have a normal development and to learn social skills and to have a positive upbringing. And so these movies where they, even if it is a horror theme, right, it's still depicting chimpanzees in this very human setting. And there's been a ton of published studies on imagery like this, making people think that they make good pets and making people think that they're not endangered in the wild. So you can imagine, just from a conservation perspective alone, I think the film, without addressing that, you know, certainly can do damage in that space. Especially imagery without context, we know, can go viral, and you really have no control over what message is taken from it. Right. Then there's the next added layer of them being extremely aggressive, which it sounds like, from your impressions, was probably a key point of the film.
Yeah, it's weird because it feels like maybe the film is building off the central folly of, like, having a chimpanzee enclosed in your house. But on the other side of it, it's also portrayed as a research study. Like, it's portrayed as this chimp is a part of a research study to, like, learn language, because it sort of combines a lot of different famous ape experiments. Like, at some points, Ben the chimp is speaking in sign language. At other points, he's using the lexigram to say, like, I'm gonna kill you, or whatever.
basically.
Basically. And at other points he's just sort of hanging out around the house. I don't know. It's very, and I think there was, I don't remember specifically which experiment it was, but I believe there was at some point an experiment where they tried to sort of raise a baby chimp mm-hmm. as a human, essentially, mm-hmm. and it went very poorly, obviously. So a weird mixture of all these things. But at the same time, the central, I guess, sort of turning point for the chimp becoming aggressive is getting rabies, which is never really explained very well. And it's sort of blamed on the rabies. So it's like, I guess you could say, like, oh, it scares people just out of ever rabies. Wanting a pet primate. But, like,
yeah. mm-hmm.
at yeah. the same time, someone could be that and be like, oh, if I could get a chimp, and as long as it doesn't get rabies, it's
right,
fine.
Right, right. As long as it doesn't have rabies. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
I like that thing you said about the images without context, or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because the movie does try very hard to use scientific research and things like, oh, but at the end of the day, the image is of a chimp pet, a pet chimp in right. your house that you hang yeah. out with.
And I think chimpanzees, while they certainly can be aggressive, have kind of in some ways gotten this bad rap of like the most aggressive and therefore terrifying animal. And, you know, this doesn't help that imagery either. I think that in
right.
it's great that maybe a takeaway is they're too aggressive to keep as a pet. But if the entire imagery is around the context of them in human clothing, using human artifacts, interacting in direct contact with humans in human houses and things like that, you know, some of these other kind of minute details get lost. And I fear that, you know, either the takeaway is they're extremely aggressive and terrifying and don't maybe, you know, like in the shark case, don't deserve as much respect and conservation care and efforts to be made. Or is it they can become my cute, cuddly friend to hang out with me? And I think that either of those are a negative outcome there.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And I know I don't expect that many people are coming to this episode new, but I do want to say you did mention earlier about when these chimps or these apes are generally are trafficked. It's the baby apes that are trafficked.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is when they get to like adulthood that they become uncontrollable, and like you can have this socially maladjusted, poorly treated baby or like adolescent ape, and then when they get to adult age, that causes problems for people. And I mean, I don't know about how all the bonobos at the Ape Cognition, the Ape Initiative, how they got there. But I know that a lot of like sanctuaries and whatnot, they rescue those trafficked mm-hmm. chimps. Do y'all mm-hmm. work with those types of sanctuaries and stuff at all?
That's an awesome question. So that's kind of like a multiple answers to that. So to answer the first one, like chimpanzees and orangutans were the most popular, were often used in Hollywood and entertainment and as circus acts and as birthday party attendants. And so it's understandable, and I don't mean acceptable. I mean, the fact that young individuals are being taken, or infants are being taken on purpose, because you can raise them with a human without the, you know, trying to interact with an adult chimpanzee. And the problem is that those individuals do grow older, and there are a lot of chimpanzees that have missing canine teeth or are even castrated in an effort to keep them more manageable and handleable. So a lot of invasive stuff done to them, and by the time it's called age out of that system, there are no efforts at the time in place to help them. So a lot of sanctuaries in the U.S., Save the Chimps, Center for Great Apes being two of them, have rescued animals from these kind of former pet trade or Hollywood and film industry trade situations. And they have a very, very hard time adjusting. I think that the sanctuaries do a phenomenal job of providing them a great life after those terrible early experiences, but those individual chimpanzees have a very hard time adjusting in social groups. They produce a lot of what we call stereotypies or repetitive behaviors, sometimes even some self-directed or self-injurious behaviors. as a function of not having the proper social and early developmental rearing. And so there's a lot of great work done for, you know, these kind of retired animals. Chimpanzees are obviously the most well-known that have ended up in that space. But other animals have a lot of different rearing experiences as well. And so there are a lot of pet chimpanzees that actually are still legally kept in households in the United States. So something the Lincoln Park Zoo is championing on behalf of the field is called the Captive Primate Safety Act. So looking to federally ban the ownership of primates in private ownership in the United States. I think efforts like that are super necessary to get us to a better place. And so Ape Initiative supports a lot of those efforts to try and make a larger community to support policy change. We also help fundraise when we can for the only bonobo sanctuary. So chimpanzees are found across Eastern and Western Africa and even Central Africa, even though they're endangered. But bonobos are only found in the Democratic Republic of Congo in one small area south of the Congo River. And so there's one sanctuary in the world that deals with orphaned bonobos and raises them, has a life for them there at sanctuary, and then has even had success rewilding some of these individuals. And so that sanctuary is called Lowly Ya Bonobo in the DRC, and a group we, you know, hope to continue to keep supporting in those efforts. And then one other piece I think that's really important here is the education one, which oftentimes I think gets missed. So an opportunity like the one we're taking right now to talk about bonobos and their endangered status and what people can do to help is one way we can help also contribute to conservation efforts and help stop some of these illegal pet trade and other efforts like that that negatively impact these species.
Yeah, no, there's I've sort of been following, on social media, literally following, but the Lowly Ya Bonobo, and I believe they have their sort of American base of operations actually pretty close by to me, North Carolina and Durham. Yep. So part of the reason I knew about them, pretty cool. But yeah, I mean, bonobos are, I'd say they're more well known now, especially because of great ambassadors like Hanzi. I mean, for a while, I don't remember when exactly, but they were considered pygmy, quote-unquote, chimpanzees for a while, like not even a fully separate species, I believe, which was, you know, obviously we know now that's different.
Yeah, so it was like the late 1920s, I believe, is when they first started being recognized as a separate species. And I think even now today, to most people, if you showed them a picture of a bonobo, I think their first guess would be chimpanzee. Yeah. And that's something I think Ape Initiative, that's like one of our big kind of core mission things we need to help kind of combat, is this idea that bonobos are not as well known. And when I tell people I work with bonobos, I often have to have the caveat, they're like chimpanzees. But if I were just saying I work with chimpanzees, there would be no caveat there. And so I think that that's an important distinction. Out of the great apes, they're still definitely the least recognized. And I think that people are oftentimes really quite surprised to find out just how much like us they are.
Yeah, we've definitely talked about some of their more interesting behaviors on the podcast before, but it sounded like, Greg, you had a question.
I do have a question for you, and I don't want to backtrack too far, but you did mention that when the juveniles are the ones who are trafficked, that in general the adults are killed and eaten, I'm assuming that's part of the bushmeat trade that happens. What, I guess, is that a byproduct of the trafficking, or is that something that is already like a normal activity, or are they saying, well, we're getting the we need to kidnap the baby, we can do this as well because we're here and it's a subsistence economy in the Congo.
Yeah. Which came first, the bushmeat or the baby?
No, that's an absolutely fabulous question. I think that as best as I can guess in this space, and, you know, one that I could continue to educate myself in. I obviously think that bushmeat has been a cultural part of many communities' livelihoods for a very long time. And I find this a very difficult but important topic to be talking about, because we're talking about people feeding themselves. And we're talking about taking away a food source in order to have respect for a non-human being. And their life and livelihood. And so I think that this is something that needs to be, you know, handled with care and understanding and open-mindedness. I think that it is very discouraging and disappointing that it is still so prevalent, and that it needs to be so prevalent. And this is in by no means, you know, supporting the bushmeat trade, but this is just in saying that this is always going to be an evolving conversation, and I don't think there's a one right answer fits all in this scenario. But I think that the trade itself for the infants and the pet trade has been after the bushmeat trade fact, and I think that stems from the ability to readily get access to material that makes you want to have those babies. I think that people are able to scroll content so quickly and easily now. They have a pipeline to access different people across the globe that never existed before. The babies aren't being stolen to be sold as pets to families living in the DRC. Families that are living in the DRC might have that infant for a short period of time, but they are being sold to other countries that have a market and have the ability to fund something like that. It is, I'll say it this way. I think that when the adults are killed, you know, the money that's being made off of them is sold as meat in markets to local people, and the money that's made off the infants is sold to people outside of their community in a much larger scale industry that, you know, has a much longer standing space to have a negative impact, I guess I could say.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes total sense.
No, I don't think we should go into the gruesome details, but we've covered and talked about, you know, the content of production cycles of like baby monkey videos and baby monkey torture videos, and how it's those same people making that content are like attracting an audience from overseas, and then there are overseas like American citizens who are partaking in the trade and like buying them from the DRC, bringing them into the United States and all over. You know, these types of places where this trade is really prevalent.
And it's becoming more and more difficult to tell the difference between quality and accredited content and not. And I think that's becoming challenging for people as well. You see, you know, something that's starting to blur the line of this place looks like a sanctuary. They look like a place that advertises themselves as a place that's doing good, but people are holding the chimpanzees in every single photo. And so it's also becoming a much harder line, I think, for people to draw for themselves when they're getting flushed with all of this content.
We've talked a lot in the, there's a lot of things that this brought up in my mind of like things we've talked about in the past or just things I've thought about in general. But, you know, there's such a, especially with social media, making just like the spectacle itself profitable. It's made everything super hard because there are people who will get a pet monkey and then file for some kind of like bogus certification and say like, we're an accredited sanctuary. It's not like accredited with the sanctuaries that reputable places accredit themselves with, or it's maybe like just coasting by on USDA standards. But there's a lot of like purposeful blurring of lines because when education increases, you know, there's people who will ask, like, are you having this as a pet or are you a sanctuary? And so there's crafty ways to get around that. And I think ultimately with both the demand for this kind of content and the ability to act on that demand and or rather create that demand and just ask for a pet baby monkey, because we've also done this in the past. It's kind of horrifying, but if you just search like spider monkey on TikTok, you'll see like tons and tons of pet owners with spider monkeys. I assume spider monkeys because they're in, you know, Mexico and relatively close to America. It's probably a bit easier to traffic them, but
I also think the chimp crazy advertisements with the woman holding the spider monkey did not help.
Yeah.
No, they did not.
Yeah, so much out of context stuff. Chimp crazy itself, like, ostensibly against having pet primates, like, the messaging of it, but when you see, like, the sort of, again, the spectacle of the advertisements drawing you in, sometimes that's all people see, and they don't bother to, like, look into the show itself, and that can have a
I think Tiger King is the perfect example. Like, they saw an increase in ticket sales at every one of the locations that was featured in the movie after what was, like, an expose on how they were mishandling and quite frankly, abusing animals. And so you do have, I mean, I myself as a person who follows accredited organizations, my social media feeds, because the algorithm knows I like content of primates, is filled with pet primate content. And it's to the point where I can't report enough. And it is, you know, like I sometimes just have to stop scrolling because it feels like all encompassing at some level.
Yeah, I mean, it's very funny. A few weeks ago, I had this happen to me in real life with a pet monkey, like a pet primate. So in my day job, because this, as much as we'd love it to, does not pay my bills. In my day job, I work at a bank. And I'm at the bank, and a woman comes by with a marmoset, just with her. And it's like, you know, I don't live in the climate that marmoset should be in, first off.
Right.
Second off, like, it's being treated like a person, right?
It's at the bank.
It's this obvious, it's this obvious form of animal abuse. But, like, you sound just, it makes you sound a little bit insane if you're, like, the only person in the room. Everybody's going, oh, baby monkey. And you're like, this is bad. This is, like, you shouldn't have this animal. Who am I supposed to?
Because, like, then you're the bad guy for bringing it up.
Like, it's one of those things where it's, like, at the end of the day, like, I report this to, what, the North Carolina Department of Natural Resources, and they probably do nothing about it.
Because it's not really illegal. They've
probably gotten a call about this woman a million times before, and if they go into this house and the monkey's not bleeding out, and, you know, there's no obvious signs of distress, what is some guy who got a bachelor's degree in, like, social work going to do with a marmoset? I mean, they're just not going to know what to do with it, much less where would they take it, right? Can't take it to the pound. It's just, like, these compounding issues where it's like, this person is 100%. Getting away with it. They're just they're getting away with it. They walk around town. Everybody loves them in their marmoset. But, like, that poor animal is suffering.
I'm glad you brought up the Captive Primate Safety Act also, because that's something I've been following as well. I even tried, like, talking to all my representatives about it, because, like, in North Carolina, it's one of those states where really just anything flies sometimes, and that's not good. It's pretty bad, in fact. But it's just so hard to, because you can educate people, like, all you want. Like, I'm constantly having to be that guy with my family members who know, you know, I work with monkeys. You know, for the past, ever since starting this podcast and before that too, really the reason I started this podcast was because I started working in, like, animal husbandry at, like, zoos, sanctuaries. I've been all over the place, but they know that I work with monkeys and that I like monkeys, and I got a degree in anthropology because I like monkeys, and it's in that department. And so they're always trying to send me, like, these Instagram reels of pet monkeys, and I have to be like, well, you know, that's not really good. And they're like, no, it's cute. He's eating Cheerios. That's not mistreatment. He's eating candy. He's living his best life. Like, no, no,
people,
it's really
seem
not.
To forget that, like, you wouldn't give your dog, in most cases, Cheerios and candy.
Yeah.
They're not supposed to have it.
But I think to, like, you know, the credit of your family members who are having those reactions, that's what the person posting that content is expecting and wants by posting it. And I think, Austin, you and I have briefly been able to talk about this in the past, but that is something Ape Initiative, I, as the director of communications, like, we are very diligent about is the content that we put out on social media and what we are willing and willing not to show. And that's not from a trying to have secrecy or privacy of the way the bonobos are cared for. We couldn't be more open about that. But there's just certain content we feel is going to give people the wrong impression about this, you know, pet complicated issue. And the best example I have is that every day the bonobos brush their own teeth. So they brush their own teeth with a toothbrush and toothpaste. They let the staff help brush their teeth in hard to reach places. It is absolutely adorable watching Tico, listening to him as he's swishing back there brushing his own teeth. But we have never posted a video of it because that is so iconically human that it's something that we feel like no matter what you put in the caption, no matter how many times you try to tell people, that video is going to make someone say, oh my gosh, that's so cute, I want one. And it may just in fact lead someone to go get a marmoset to take to the bank with them because that's their closest equivalent, right?
Right. And like, especially with these little monkeys, it feels like, oh, it's okay, it's a little monkey, you know, it's not one of the big scary ones that's going to hurt me, but it's like at the,
it's like a lap dog.
But like, you're hurting the animal is the important part there. Like, right. Even with like big chimpanzees, like Travis is obviously the most notorious case. And like, he was still like walking around town with that family for like a decade and no one was saying anything. Like, some people are like, maybe that's dangerous, but you know, no one was really like calling them out on the fact that this is clearly like an abusive, unnatural situation. And part of that is because as much as we try to educate people, if our laws aren't really backing us up here, if we can't get some sort of legal enforcement of this, the second best thing we can do is sort of what you do for work is try to control what information comes out, only good information rather than stuff that could be misconstrued. And that's something that's sort of a constant struggle with not just, you know, our particular field, primates generally, but academia in general, really, is there's such a huge problem with putting out work and trying to control how it's interpreted because, you know, you could put out a study and have some, like, really iffy pop science journal, like, say, like, for example, like, people who work in, like, space-related things probably have to deal with their research constantly being used to be like, is this an alien? But it's so hard to control what happens with your work, academic or otherwise, once it's out there in the world. And so you got to be really careful about it.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, and it's something, like, you know, I just quite frankly lose sleep over sometimes because it's such a hard challenge. Like, there are sanctuaries that depend, you know, Ape Initiative is a nonprofit. Like, we depend on donations from individuals, not just, you know, foundations or anything like that, from individuals to take good care of the bonobos and to provide them with the lives that they need. And so you want to connect people to the species. And so, you know, the content of showing them look a lot like a human and doing human, very human things, like, that gets people engaged. That makes people say, oh my gosh, I want one. They're just like me. And it's such a hard challenge of being like, we want to get people to care about these individuals or these species, but we are somehow, are we inadvertently, by putting content out about them, you know, leading to more individuals being taken from the wild to fuel this pet trade. And it's something I think, you know, having conversations like this is so important about, to just like, where is the line? How do we define that line? Where do we draw it? Who gets to decide where we draw it? You know, are we going to see sanctuary suffering because they can't post that content? I don't know. And so it's something, you know, we can try to be thoughtful of, but obviously, you know, always room for improvement.
Yeah, it's something I've noticed as like a constant struggle with the nonprofit nature of the animal field is, you know, beyond the fact that you really kind of have to like save money and that ends up with you know, workers not getting paid very well often. And it's, you know, everyone who's in the field is doing it out of passion. They're not doing it because they're making like crazy money. So everyone is, I guess, with maybe rare exceptions, very passionate and enthusiastic about the work they do, and they want to share it with people, and they want this to be like not profitable but sustainable. And the best way to get attention in this sort of, I guess, social media economy that we live in is to have viral moments. And for zoos, it can maybe sometimes be easier because their enclosures, for example, are designed with public viewing in mind, and anything you can sort of record from the enclosure is something that's generally good or fine for the public to see. But with everyone else, it can be especially hard. But I think one really fun example that I liked was that video of Kanzi playing Minecraft that you guys put out. It was very cool. I liked it a lot. I also liked that there was sort of documentation on how the Minecraft mod worked, because I looked into that because I was so curious how how Kanzi managed to hit a water bucket clutch in Minecraft against the Ender Dragon that I had to look up how he did it. So that was very cool.
That is like one of the more fun and kind of perfect examples of like where I think the educational outreach space is going and should be going. So that was actually a YouTuber, Chris DeCow. He was creating a ton of Minecraft content, had a few viral videos in the Minecraft space that were, you know, performing extremely well. And he was like, had this idea, could I teach, you know, a non-human primate to play Minecraft, and approached us about this. And we worked with him for a while on kind of figuring out the logistics of how we could set it up for Kanzi. And that is the thing where, like, I have gone to middle schools in Nashville to talk to them about bonobos, and kids in the audience will see my shirt and be like, that's that Minecraft bonobo. I've seen that video. Like, you know, people at swim meets are running into each other saying, oh my gosh, you know the Minecraft bonobo? Like, the idea that that became like almost a sensation in and of itself, you know, was incredible. And I think it does show like people are eager to connect to, you know, individuals like Kanzi, or to connect to non-human animals like the bonobos. And I think that, you know, we were thoughtful and had to talk a lot in that video about, you know, the endangerment status of bonobos and how connecting people to them through Minecraft was a cool way to do it. But yeah, I think that that space is ever evolving, and people are coming up with new and exciting ways. You know, the video is entertaining. The bonobos aren't the entertainment, if that makes sense. And I think that's an important space to be getting into.
Right, yeah, exactly.
I think it's super interesting. And like, this is kind of like the hope of the future of it, because I know the four of us sitting here are probably far too plugged into Monkey Kong on the computer than anyone else in the whole world. But, you know, it feels like every few months, someone gets busted having a capuchin who's just like, whose bones are disintegrating because they've been feeding it Cheez-Its. And if you go on Instagram and you type in monkey or capuchin, there are hundreds of thousands of reels and posts of people who have a pet like this, who are dressing it up, and who are going viral. I don't really know who they're going viral with, because I've never met anybody who's watching it, but like, they're getting tens of thousons of likes, hundreds
millions
of thousands
of
views.
Millions of views.
Millions and millions of views. And there's millions of those people. There's probably thousands of people with pet primates just in the U.S., and there's one Ape Initiative, right? So, like, creating this kind of content that can go viral, that can kind of break through the kind of undercurrent of social media and have a positive impact is so meaningful when you have to compete against, you know, 100 videos a day from somebody who lives in, like, a shack in Texas and has 50 capuchins in there with him. So, like, I think that that's super cool. And, like, I see all that content. I hope more people see that content. I hope it's not because, you know, people like us are already so plugged in that, like, I'm going to get it no matter what. I just really, really like that. I think mm-hmm. it's great.
Thank you, Greg. That's awesome. No, I appreciate that. And I think that like, I'm going to steal your way of saying it in order to kind of like, you know, relay to some of the team, because I think it's sometimes hard for us to see the bigger picture through the day to day. Because at the end of the day, like, there are 6 bonobos that live at Ape Initiative that need our full attention and need quality care and need, you know, enrichment and fun surprises and all the good stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, the ability to partner with content creators has been an avenue for us as an organization where we are getting reach that we quite frankly never knew was possible. And I mean that in that we've had some traditional media spotlights and things like that, and we'll see a big surge to the website that day, but you really don't capture a lot of those people. They're not, you know, keeping up with it. We had another YouTube collaboration with Shauma NYC, who is a polyglot who learns languages, and his whole, you know, kind of genre is like the shock factor. So going into neighborhoods or restaurants or even to different countries.
Oh, one of those guys.
Ordering in perfect Chinese. Yeah,
and
I've seen that.
Ordering in perfect Mandarin and shocking everyone. And so he came to us with the idea of learning to communicate with the bonobos. And so I actually spent weeks video chatting with him, teaching him how to make bonobo vocalizations and gestures, and teaching him, you know, kind of the bonobo language, if you will. And that video, I think, now has over 15 million views on YouTube. It was like trending number 18 when it first was launched, and it was our most successful one-off fundraiser. And so it brought not only donations through YouTube, but a ton of people to our website that gave and consistently now give, or are sending the bonobos things from their wish list and things like that, that all name this video as how they learned about Ape Initiative or how they learned about bonobos. And like the idea that this whole, you know, kind of audience of people who aren't as plugged in necessarily as, you know, the four of us are in this primate space, like, you know, just having the commonality of like, oh, another language. And like the idea that that was enough of a tie to get, you know, 15 million people to be engaged with that content is tremendous. And I think that those types of partnerships are much more in the space we want to be going than, you know, some of the viral moments ourselves. Because I do think when you're talking about those viral moments on our, you know, TikTok, Ape Initiative isn't on TikTok. And I think for probably many of the reasons we've all discussed on this call. So yeah, thank you for saying that, and thank you for the space to talk about it more.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think one benefit of having a super niche podcast is maybe it doesn't make a whole lot of money, but I mean, it's good to put out episodes like that. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to, like,
for all of us are in this.
That wasn't a dig, but yeah, but part of it is
Chandler,
like,
and I thought we were.
right.
Being
it turns out to all be a lie.
Yeah, it is. It's a wonderful passion.
There's a benefit to having an audience who's like able to process these higher level conversations where normally it would just sort of happen between like people who are like really ingrained in this. But I'm excited for more people to hear about this, more about the sort of philosophy going into creating content for a nonprofit bonobo center, which is like, it's a I struggle to find the words there because it is like a really unique arrangement. There's only
talk about niche.
I mean, it's pretty much just you guys.
Yep, and you know, there's only one sanctuary for bonobos as well, and so I think that, you know, that probably speaks to how much more work needs to be done in this space to help. I mean, I'm glad that there aren't a lot of sanctuaries that need to exist to house orphaned bonobos in the United States. I'm very grateful for that. But I think in terms of efforts to help educate people and connect to the species, there aren't a lot of places existing in the world to do that for bonobos. So we're glad to be a big part of that.
Yeah, definitely. So, it just makes me like a little bit, it irritated me seeing the lexicram in the movie a little bit, because it's like, because this could have been like you I don't think it would have been necessarily like advantageous at all to like have a partnership with a horror movie, but like if at least like someone from Paramount was able to like sit down and like hear somebody out about like maybe don't like portray, I don't know, just something like that.
If the production team had tried to collaborate with, like, you know, anybody, where's really, the disclaimer? Anybody
where's the space?
About.
Yeah, like I think that they missed a huge opportunity to help educate people. Like, you know, we can talk about, we did talk about, but we could talk a lot longer about, you know, the film and what it portrays and what the impact of that all is. But there's also a ton to just do in that space to offset maybe some of these negative things that we talked about the film could be doing. And I think in terms of educating people and then like put your money where your mouth is, like put, you know, funds towards helping properly care for these animals that have been, you know, victims of a industry that is now kind of bringing them back into the picture and space in a negative way. So
yeah, I think Nope by Jordan Peele was very interesting because the messaging of the movie was like very clear about how exploitation of animal, like it felt more like subtle and what's the word? And I guess intelligent than this movie.
It was a movie made by real filmmakers. and not a slasher director.
It felt like there was some intention behind what it was trying to say with like the exploitation of animals for use and entertainment, and that was very interesting. And you know, that makes for like really interesting opportunities when it comes to shocking subjects, like to draw people in with like an initial shock is something that is always going to work more or less, I think, regardless of any economic incentives. Because, you know, for example, like seeing Kanzi play Minecraft is like mind blowing. So it works really well and it draws people in to have like a genuinely educational experience. And that's what it should be. But, you know, it does feel like stuff like this sort of muddies the water when it's just drawing you in for the shock value just to sort of do nothing with it. So it feels like a missed opportunity, I guess. But also, you know, this movie kind of felt like a net zero impact on the world. Maybe probably negative, if anything. But I don't know. We might be too harsh on the movie, but I don't know. It wasn't...
wasn't a good movie. If it had any film merits, I'd give it to it.
Well, I think that, you know, when you were describing it to me, the like research component of it sounds a lot like the Planet of the Apes film with Caesar and with James Franco's character when he's like doing the Alzheimer's drug research in that film. Like, that's been played. We've seen that. And actually, like, you know, at least in some ways, I think that film probably, you know, it came out at a much different time when we weren't as educated about this space. But also, yeah, I think missed opportunity is, you know, the large take home that I would have from it, having not seen the film and not going to see the film, that I think that, you know, when you think of a viral moment like this, like someone's benefiting off of that, like, you know, organizations are making money off of that, like there's a goal to that with a financial component. And it always makes me wonder, like, well, where and how is that reaching the species that you're depicting? And I think that, you know, if nothing else, to educate people about where they can put their dollars to help chimpanzees that are retired from the, you know, Hollywood industry would have been a really, really good use of resources and time, and probably wouldn't have taken much to do. So maybe they'll shock us and we'll find out that, you know, the primate film is now funding a documentary on the illegal pet trade in Uganda, for example. But I highly doubt it.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of doubt that. But yeah, I guess it does remind me, so much academic stuff is ostensibly in the public domain. There's obviously a lot of variability there because like everyone gets asked if they want to purchase copyright protection for their master's thesis, for example, which, you know, nobody's like, that's, you know, that's not worth it. But also at the same time, academic and research stuff just sort of being the public good that it is, which is, you know, a good thing, people should be able to benefit pretty equally from new knowledge that gets generated. But again, going back to what I said earlier about it can also be misused, and it's hard to figure out, like, what the balance of control you could or should reasonably be allowed to have over what happens with, you know, research that you do. And it obviously comes down a lot to laws, and maybe not even, you know, when it comes to nonprofit stuff, like, we can't, like, force movies to give to nonprofits, for example. No, but no. I don't know, just something, if there was, I don't know, some kind of foundation, or at least like a commitment on paper or something nice like that from Hollywood to sort of, you know, make relevant concessions to things that it's depicting when it comes to sensitive topics. But
I mean, there are still shows with primates in them now. Apple TV had one.
Yeah.
With Vince Vaughn not that long ago, with a capuchin. One of the Netflix shows had a squirrel monkey in it. I mean, it is, I think, unfortunately, for some of the other primate species, like the monkeys, the chimpanzees did get some attention in that space and maybe are seen as more threatening and dangerous. So people might be either harder to get or less likely to have them. But in terms of, like, smaller primates, a lot of New World monkeys especially, like, we are seeing, like, drastically increasing numbers of them being trafficked. And I think that's direct. I would, you know, beg that, you know, that's a direct line between the content that's being shared about them and the, like, virality of that content and people's ease and access to resources like that.
Yeah. A lot of it also comes down to social media websites. They're probably not going to be legally forced to, but so much of this problem would be nipped in the bud if social media websites were consistent or meaningful. Yes. And proactive in their enforcement.
They had any real mechanism for reporting it other than saying animal abuse. Because, like, I will just tell you, the instant response I get back when reporting that content is, this isn't violent in the way that they define violence. But, you know, something doesn't have to be violent to be abusive. And so I think that, you know, if the Captive Primate Safety Act got passed, if there were, you know, some popular legislative things going on that people could cling to that could push social media, you know, Meta or whomever into banning those types of things. But unfortunately, I think that they also like having viral content on their platforms. And, you know, it will take a very bold, courageous person to finally put their foot down and make some mandates against that stuff. Because right now, I think it is absolutely contributing to it. Like, it is a conduit for the trade.
Yeah. No, it's completely out of control. And, you know, I'm assuming when social media companies get advisors and consultants to, you know, give them guidance for moderation and things, they're not typically consulting experts on, you know, exotic pet trafficking when it comes to this. So they're not really, like, even having this conversation in the first place. So it's so hard to get this across to people except through sort of alternative routes. Ideally, like this podcast, you know, if stuff like this gets reach and we can reach even, like, just whoever's listening, and maybe if people who are listening can, like, tell other people about it, you know, even better. I mean, if you're listening to this, it's important to give money to effective organizations and nonprofits like the Ape Initiative. We'll put a link to donate in the description. But yeah, I mean, like, beyond just education, it's important to have, like, real advocates. So I think stuff like what you're doing is super important, because just having one-on-one conversations with your mom when she sends you a monkey reel is, you know, it's a small step, and it's worth doing, but it's not enough always.
Sometimes you just got to be that guy, you know, and as hard and annoying
as
it might
be. Yeah, I mean,
be,
yeah.
we all can relate to the fact that we're just going to keep being that guy. And so, you know, thank you for having me and giving Ape Initiative and myself a space to be able to talk about this issue that's so near and dear to me. And I think, you know, we always leave younger school groups by saying, like, if you take nothing else from today, you know, tell someone else about bonobos. And I think I'd extend it to this, you know, very well-versed audience to say, you know, like, go tell someone about the illegal pet trade and how you're not going to share content like that online. And go be that guy, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Austin.
I think we have said, like, verbatim on the show before, it's annoying, but we all have to start being the annoying guy sometimes. Like, it's, I think, like, maybe even just doing it until it becomes not as much of a taboo to be that annoying guy, like, that'll help, because then people will know and you won't be annoying for bringing it up, you know. But yeah.
All right, well, I don't know, is there any, I think you wrapped everything up pretty nicely.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sarah Skiba, for coming onto the show. Like Austin and you said, you can go to apeinitiative.org if anything that Dr. Skiba taught you today was interesting and you want to learn more. You can learn more about their mission. You can donate there. Yeah, I don't know. Does anybody have any last words for our audience?
Yeah. I want to thank you for coming on again, Dr. Skiba. It's been... You're probably the most distinguished and educated person we've ever had on this show.
No offense to our other guests, but...
I think they would think it's funny.
We won't tell our other guests that you're our favorite.
No, this has been absolutely wonderful and enlightening. And I know on this show we don't know anything. Chandra and I don't know anything. Austin's the one with the monkey knowledge. So it's been educational, I think, for the three of us as well. Please go to the Ape Initiative website. Go check that out, everybody. And if you like us, you guys know where to find us already. All our links will be down below. Thank you all.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, y'all.
All right.